Welcome to the Gooder Podcast, where we talk with powerhouse women in CPG about their journeys to success. This episode is sponsored by Retail Voodoo, a brand development firm guiding mission-driven consumer brands to attract new and passionate consumer base, crush their categories through growth and innovation, and magnify their social and environmental impact. If your brand is in need of brand positioning, package design, or marketing activation, we are here to help. You can find more information at www.retail-voodoo.com.
Hi, Diana Frike here. I'm the host of the Gooder Podcast, where I get to talk with the powerhouse women in the food, beverage, and wellness categories about their journeys to success and their insights on the industry. Thanks for joining us today. Really quick here, this episode is brought to you by Retail Voodoo. Retail Voodoo is a brand development firm. Our clients include Starbucks, Kind, REI, PepsiCo, Hi-Key, and many other market leaders. We provide strategic brand and design services for leading brands in the food, wellness, beverage, and fitness industry. If your goal is to increase market share, drive growth, or disrupt the marketplace with new innovative ideas, give us a call and let's talk. And for more information about Retail Voodoo, you can visit retail-voodoo.com or email info@retailvoodoo.com. Well, today we get to talk about culture fusion, entrepreneurship, and coffee by way of Debbie Y. Mullen. Debbie left her career at the World Bank in supply chain management to create a business based on two of her biggest passions, Vietnamese cuisine and sustainable development. Over the past 5 years, Debbie has grown Copper Cow Coffee to support sustainable farms in Vietnam, now sold in over 3,000 retailers, including Whole Foods and Sprouts. Well, hello, Debbie. How are you today?
Thanks. Hi. Welcome. Very excited to be here.
Yeah. Where are you calling from today?
I'm coming from Los Angeles, California.
Oh, good old LA. We're in the same time zone. I love it when that happens.
Yes, it seems rare these days. So it's the first thing you ask somebody is where they are. And it might be different every call you have with them.
Yes. And even with the same people, because people are starting to move around a little bit more.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, before we get into the really meaty stuff, I always like to give my guests an opportunity to share about their brand. Can you tell us a little bit about Copper Cow Coffee and why it exists?
Yeah, so Copper Cow Coffee is the first premium Vietnamese coffee company in the U.S. So it's really exciting to be able to connect sustainable farms with the American specialty coffee market, which is the largest specialty coffee market in the world. Mm-hmm. And we do so with our signature product, which is our pour-over latte kits. So you can brew a perfect latte anywhere, no equipment required. We have these handy little single-serve filters that fit over any cup. And then we make our own secret creamers that are really awesome.
Yes.
And yeah, you can buy the whole kits on our website or in stores.
Awesome. So tell us, for those of us that are maybe not coffee aficionados, tell us a little bit about the difference between Vietnamese coffee, its flavors, etc., versus what the average coffee drinker can get in the market right now.
Absolutely. So that's a very good question. And there's multiple ways that you can define Vietnamese coffee, actually, because you can sometimes see it on menus in places like, I know down here, Groundworks has a Vietnamese coffee that they have on their menu, but it's actually, they just serve it with condensed milk. So there's a few ways that we here at Copper Cow Coffee define Vietnamese coffee. The first and foremost is that it comes from Vietnam. Vietnam is actually the second largest coffee producer in the world, and it's known for having these really strong coffee beans that are rich with like mocha and nutty undertones. It's a little bit different than what you would get in South America or Africa, which will have more floral or fruity tones. So that goes really well with how it's traditionally served, which is a really strong and with sweetened condensed milk. So it's like nice and caramelly with this sweetened condensed milk. So sometimes people just associate Vietnamese coffee for that part. But for us, we really believe in highlighting the region and the agricultural story that we're supporting.
Gotcha. I have a strange, weird, tangential question. I'm noticing a lot of beverages, at least the ones that I run into, that are from Vietnam, have a lot of milk or heavy cream in them. Is that a inaccurate observation, or is that just what Americans are drawn towards, or those ones that are creamier?
I think it might be a bit of both. So okay. in Vietnam, you definitely, like, coffee is almost always drank with cream.
Okay.
But it's usually with sweetened condensed milk. So because I think that back from, you know, it's a really, really hot tropical country. So refrigeration was an issue, which is why sweetened condensed milk is shelf stable, which is why we can just package it on a box and a shelf. That was why it proliferated in the country. But then also, like, Vietnamese people do really love things packed with flavor. And I think that things being really creamy is normal, whether that's with condensed milk or with coconut milk. I think that if you find something in the US, I mean, we love things like nice and rich here. So probably just the meeting of those two things combined is probably what you've experienced.
Yes. Yes. I know when I spoke with, Sashi over at Tea Drops, big fans of the boba tea and then also the milk tea here in this house too. And I'm like, okay, milk tea, and then we got milk coffee. There's a lot of milk going on. So Now, when we were preparing for this call, you had some interesting things that you wanted to share about the history of coffee and communism, which is a very, it's kind of a sordid, not fun topic between the United States and Vietnam, considering its more recent history. But it's really important component of the coffee culture, or not the coffee culture, but maybe the farming practices maybe you want. Can you share a little bit more that I know you were really interested in sharing that?
Yeah. So one thing that's really interesting about Vietnam is that it was formally colonized by the French. And that was when coffee was really introduced to the region.
Gotcha.
And it just grows so well there. It's so conducive for coffee. Mm-hmm. And so Vietnam, you see coffee totally proliferate across the country. There's just so much coffee growing. And and there's a lot of history there for the beans that are meant for French roast, which is the way that we do a dark French roast for our coffee as well. But when the communists took over, you have price setting, right? Okay. So one of the things that they do is they don't want the market to figure out prices. So no matter what quality of coffee you produced, there was one price for it. So it ended up being this, like, major degradation of quality. So while Vietnam continued to grow as an exporter in coffee, they just grew in terms of pounds, not in terms of quality.
Got it.
So that's why Vietnam is such a big coffee player, but just not in the specialty coffee space historically. Mm-hmm. And then as you see, the Vietnamese economy open up over the last 20 years, particularly the last 10 years, you see the country industrialize, a middle class emerge, and Vietnam has always, because it's such a coffee powerhouse, had a huge domestic coffee scene, coffee culture. I mean, I kid you not that if you go to Vietnam now, like, every other storefront is a coffee shop.
Really?
And everyone's always hanging out, drinking coffee. It's something that assume that someone's doing all day long, sipping on this super strong coffee with condensed milk. And so when you see this, the population evolve and begin to have disposable income, coffee is obviously a place where that goes. And so you're seeing this whole renaissance of coffee culture in Vietnam, where people really care, are beginning to ask questions of how it was grown. What's the varietal? How was it processed?
Okay.
How is it roasted? You know, they're interested in the different type of brews, from cold brew to lattes to macchiatos. And I think it's just really interesting to see that evolution. And for me to have started to look into the coffee space, this was about 7 years ago when I started asking the question of, like, what would it take to be able to do something that was similar to the third wave coffee scene I was immersed in with Blue Bottle Coffee and Phil's and all this fun stuff, but with a take on Vietnamese coffee that I had grown up with. And just when I started to talk to domestic suppliers here, you know, people were kind of laughing at me, saying, like, you can't find that grade of coffee from Vietnam. It doesn't exist. But when I traveled there totally was. It just was only being consumed domestically. So being able to support that type of farming and agricultural practices, and then most importantly, to be able to offer a price per pound that really incentivizes the quality that we're after has been really impactful.
Wow. And so that's kind of influences what you were wanting to do with Copper Cow Coffee anyways, right? Like, and there's some pride there in bringing this amazing richness of Vietnamese culture into the United States. And I don't know, do you infuse that kind of, I don't know if there's a way to say this. Do you infuse that kind of POV this of the Vietnamese people and into the brand at all? Or do you feel like you want Copper Cow to stand alone?
What I would like to do is, because something that I was really surprised about when I launched the brand mm-hmm. was that people didn't know that Vietnam even made coffee, even though when you're drinking, you know, coffee from you know who, it's from Vietnam. They just don't label it that way.
Yes.
And so I think that that's something that was really eye-opening for me, was when I started to, you know, just be at shows and asking people, do you want to try some Vietnamese coffee? The number one response I get is, what's Vietnamese coffee? I didn't know Vietnam made coffee.
Gotcha.
And so I think, you know, I'm really big. One of the things that I think starting a company has really taught me is that I can have all the ideas I want and all the ways that I want the brand to be, but I have to meet my customer where they're at. And mm-hmm. to say like for, I think that we're in a position to make Copper Cow Coffee and Vietnamese coffee synonymous
yes.
for the US market. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're trying to do today.
Right.
And so we want to highlight the farmers. We want to highlight the region. We want to highlight, you know, and what's great is that we're now seeing other Vietnamese coffee startups that
awesome.
Are premium startup. And
awesome.
We're so excited and we're all friends and we're like, all tides will rise together once people realize how amazing this inventory is.
Yeah. Well, and you have some big fans, right? Like I know you and Sashi are friends. You got some love from Shark Tank amongst, I think I saw you had a capital raise that was earlier this year. So you've mm-hmm. got a lot of people supporting you. How are you feeling about the adoption rate in the marketplace? Like, is this going as well as you wanted it to?
Is it going as well as I wanted it to? I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's hard to say that, you know, I think it's such a funny thing about like how have things turned out how you thought they would. I'd say in some ways it's so much exceeded my expectations.
Oh, really?
You know,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I set out, you know, to, you know, start a brand that would highlight Vietnamese coffee, that would show people how awesome it was, mm-hmm. that I would get to work with people that I love and try to create a household name. Like mm-hmm. those were the things that kind of got me started with it, you know, mm-hmm. and now I'm in my fifth year mm-hmm. of doing it. And I think what's funny is if you had asked me, you know, 7 years ago, like, oh, 5 years from now, you'll be at this place.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's like, I think that I was thinking much more about the destination when I started. And now that I'm 5 years in, I'm like, I can't imagine doing anything else. Like, I feel like it's mm-hmm. such a privilege to still be doing it.
Yes.
And so I think that's something that I think I'm humbled by, is just the fact that I get to work with the people that are willing to work for me, that are so incredible, and that we do have people love the product. Mm-hmm. I think that, the adoption has been quite fast. We've grown. I mean, we've over tripled in size every year for the last 3 years.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And but at the same time, like, I think that that growth rate comes with challenges. You know, we're very sustainability focused, and there's challenges that come with scale. You know, these handshake agreements that you start a business with are really different than what you do when you're a national Whole Foods brand with a major
yes.
supply demands. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that, These are all welcomed challenges because you're at the beginning, you're just trying to convince people that you're really going to do something. And then now that you're doing it, how are you going to really stay true to all of those things that you set out to? So I think that in some ways it's better than I ever thought it would be. And then in some ways it's so much more challenging too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my business partner and I, when we talk about those issues, we call them better challenges instead of bigger or different, you know, because you want your challenges to always be a bigger challenge than what you started off with. Like, oh, how do I support 1,000 doors versus 500 doors? Yeah.
Totally.
Oh, how am I going to get ingredients for X number versus X number. So I get it. So let's jump back for just a moment to the Debbie that's at World Bank doing now. So you were working on supply chain, correct?
Right. So I was, I was working on projects at the World Bank. So financing projects that would support supply chain development in Asia.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So was there something that happened in your time at World Bank? Was there something seeding you there that started pointing you in this direction of Copper Cow Coffee?
There were many things. Okay. And it's interesting because over the course of the first part of my career working in international development, mm-hmm. I think what happened was it's so different than this, where I kept thinking like, oh, if I get to this point, it's mm-hmm. not going to feel like this anymore. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it just kept feeling a little bit worse. And I think that that's for a number of reasons. One being that it was just a really, really big bureaucratic place. So yeah. Culturally, that was really hard for me because I would have really crazy ideas and want to do things really differently, yes. or want to work a lot faster. And culturally, that really rubbed people the wrong way, mm-hmm. Especially it was a place that was very honestly ageist, mm-hmm. being a young female. It was really hard. It felt like to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. So I think there were all these things that were just a terrible cultural fit for me. Mm-hmm. And then, what's really interesting is that I think a lot about how, having a kid, yes. has like influence, or being a mom or thinking about being a mom has influenced yes. me towards this path.
Really?
Even though oftentimes, you think about like, is it possible to do something as crazy as this? Mm-hmm. But I remember, I think it was my last boss at the World Bank was particularly terrible. Mm. And I remember thinking to myself, so I was getting ready to the point where I was thinking about having kids. And I was like, there's no way I would want to be away from my kid to be like
to
abused.
Be here.
Yeah, yes. to be here. And I was like, I should at least go try to do something that I really, really want to do. And so I think that there was that coupled with that, I just didn't feel effective. I didn't feel like I was like doing what I was setting out to do, which mm-hmm. I feel like I'm much more effective at with my skill set mm-hmm. and with what I'm doing today with Copper Cow Coffee, with it impacting sustainability in the region.
Got it. I think that all families, women in particular, tend to be this way, but I'm seeing particularly with younger millennials, mm-hmm. definitely with Gen Z, men and women, looking at quality of life when they're thinking about an employer and making those decisions. Now, there are plenty of people that would love to have the role that you had at World Bank, and God bless them, right? Like, let's yeah. help them have that. It is interesting to think starting a new business and having a young family don't seem to be compatible. And yet I will say that almost every entrepreneur, not 100% that I've interviewed so far that's been a woman, has a young family. And it seems to be having a kid or thinking about having a kid seems to be this opportunity to go, oh, I want to do something different. And if it's going to be hard, then let's be hard all the way around. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's make it worthwhile to like put your, cause I don't know. I'm a bit of a workaholic and I love mm-hmm. working. And, mm-hmm. and if I'm going to work like that, it should yep. be for a place where I can really, really dig in and feel valued.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, so you talked about kind of the big turning point for what you wanted to do, just leaving World Bank. But was there some sort of aha that said Vietnamese coffee?
Yes. And so I spent, it was about 6 months that I was beginning to really go down the, like, let me think about the entrepreneurial path. Mm-hmm. So I remember I moved to Seattle and I was fully working for the World Bank remotely.
Yes.
Knowing that I was going to leave. So doing a contract position full time that could be as long as I wanted it to be. But thinking like, I'm going to do something different. I was like interviewing with like, the Gates Foundation. And I like just wondering, not sure. And you're in Seattle. I honestly quite lost, just knew that what I was doing wasn't working, you know? And I remember thinking even, you know, I feel like I'm playing somebody else's game that I'm just like never going to win at. Like, I just remember having that feeling of like this like bureaucratic game that like really just culturally didn't fit with me. And I actually wanted to just work at a startup, but because my background looked the way it did, like people wouldn't even talk to me. And so
really,
It was really, cause they were just like, he only had really huge organization experience. Yeah. Like, and it was something that I began to say, well, if I think it's like, if I'm going to complain so much about how things are run and want to be at a startup, like I should just start my own company. And I had a bunch of really bad business ideas. And this was one of the better ones, I guess. But I actually first started off with a cooking line because there were all these like kind of like bottled products that my family would make so that you could like more easily whip up Vietnamese food at home on a weeknight. And there was this like this infused oil and vinegars that we would make that I thought would be a great business. And what's nice about that was I was able to dabble in it. Like I was able to rent commercial kitchen space in the evenings and weekends. I sold it door to door all while working full time at the World Bank. And so I think I was able to kind of dabble in it before I got to learn about distribution, how you sell things, what the market is. Just learned some of the fundamentals before, I remember having like lots of meetings with people about some other business ideas I had. And each time you'd go and have a meeting and be like, that's probably not a bad, good idea. It would put you off the scent. But once you begin to like, look more and more into the idea, you just get more and more, you know, kind of encouragement. And that's, I think that sometimes people ask me about like, there was the moment of like deciding to kind of move away from the World Bank. But like, sometimes I think about when this concept took over, one day it was like all I could think about. Like it just kind of slowly took over my brain and it was all I wanted to work on.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally do. Did you have anybody kind of guiding you? Did you have anybody in the industry? Were your parents supporting you? Like, what was that whole ecosystem like for you as you were figuring things out?
So I had my sister and my brother-in-law were entrepreneurs, and they were the ones who were pushing me really in this direction, especially my brother-in-law, because he's someone who's raised venture capital. He's had a lot of successful businesses. And so he made it look really easy. And he was the first, he was the first person to say to me that he thought that I, in particular, he's like, I feel like you have the mindset to do this. I think you have the personnel, the disposition for it. And it's funny when you think about that, like if no one had said that to me, I don't know if I would have ever, you know, you don't see a lot of women who look like me doing this. It took him saying that, being like, your mind thinks like an entrepreneur, you act like an entrepreneur, like you should do some, you get so much more excited talking about silly business ideas than about the jobs you're interviewing for. And so when I was doing the side business, he just pulled me aside. I was like, I'm really excited that you're moving forward on this. I think this could be more than a side hustle. Like I would invest if you were willing to quit your job and do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I think that was a really, you know, not everybody has somebody, you know, do that kind of vote of confidence. And, and this was kind of in the face of like my parents, especially my mother, who's a refugee from Vietnam. It was really hard for her to face it when I decided to do this. Cause you know, she has spent her whole life just trying to mitigate risk. How do I make myself, my life, my family, like, I don't know, we were talking last night and something that I didn't know is when she left Vietnam, she got on a fighter jet and literally didn't know where it was going. She's like, I didn't know if I was going to Asia. I didn't know if I was going to Hong Kong. I didn't know if I was going to the US. I had no idea. I just knew I was leaving Vietnam and that was like all I cared about. And like, he's like, you want a pension, you want a stable paycheck, you want a government job, you know? So the World Bank was really great for like her to feel really secure for me to say, you know, I remember her saying like, why would you work in food? That's what you do when you have no other skills, you know, like that's what a lot of her brothers and sisters did.
Yeah.
So open up a hot dog stand. Like, what's something that you can do, you know, that, that doesn't require any skills or language even. And I think it was just really hard for her. She's okay with it now. But I think for a long time, it was really, really hard for her. So I think I've had both ends of the spectrum with support, but definitely really, really amazing support in my family.
There we are. Sorry, okay. I don't know some tech. I can certainly understand that. My parents are immigrants, my dad, a refugee as well. And it's so funny, funny in an interesting way, because in technically, if you are self-employed, you actually have more stability because you have control of your future. You have control of the opportunity. You have to work hard. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But if you are an employee at an organization, even the larger the organization it is, you become you're an asset that the organization either needs or doesn't need. And I know that we are living in a different time now where companies look at employees differently, that type of thing. But it's employees are more expendable than, and especially since I've been working with my business partner for, 15 years now, definitely have more say over my schedule and my time. Granted, I work long hours, but I do have more control. At least I think that. I don't know if that shows up for you that way.
I feel the exact same way. And I think that resonates with my comment earlier about playing someone else's game. You know, I remember just being so frustrated when I was like, I feel like my whole career trajectory or the way, the possibility of me being able to do a project that I want to do would all rely on the opinion of one person.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether it's your boss or the person who's controlling something to do with the company, and it feeling so subjective and so difficult and so linear in a way that, like, if it didn't go the way you wanted it to, you would just get stuck. Yeah. And so as opposed to now, it's like, you know, if I pitch to an investor and ask them to invest and they say no, I'm like, all right, on to the next. Like, it's not like, or if a retailer says no, you know, that's fine. There's a million other retailers out there. You know, for every no, there's infinite yeses of like possible. And I think that that's that I felt like I suddenly now have total control over my destiny compared to before.
Yeah. And, you know, some people want that stability, and that's okay. I mean, kudos to your sister and your brother-in-law for inspiring you, encouraging you to go your own way, because you definitely, I mean, you just exude entrepreneurialism. That doesn't exist in everybody. And I'm sure you've been around plenty of people. You can identify it when it's there as well.
Totally.
Yeah. So those early days of the business and of the brand, Were there any things outside of, you know, kind of pulling things together? What were some of the big learnings for you in the early days of maybe what you didn't know and those things that kind of just stick in your brain that you wish that you could, like, to every entrepreneur, here are the five things that I did that you should not do. You know, what does that look like?
Oh, man. I mean, I can't even. I've had a lot of expensive lessons. I think that probably one of the biggest things was, you know, just knowing your market, I think is something that is, and to know that you are not your market.
Yes.
I think that that's something, like, cause preach. That first product line I made was for me. Like I would pay so much for this and I would use it all the time. And so would my friends and family, you know?
Yes.
And that was one of those things where, you know, I still think that it was a worthwhile exercise, but just not exhaustive enough in the beginning that where I made a small batch in my kitchen and learned how to bottle something, you know, learned how to make labels and just kind of came up with a little prototype and then, you know, just gave it to all my friends and family and saw if they would use it and ask for more. And they all did, you know? And so that was like this proof of concept to myself, where I remember an investor saying something like, just stand outside of Whole Foods and talk to 100 people. And I'm like, that would have been a better exercise to have done in the beginning rather than just I remember I had like some parties where we would do votes on packaging. There were mm-hmm. lots of fun things that I did, but it was always so like network centric, right? Mm-hmm. So then you end up in this like hyper foodie crowd, which is just yep. not actually yeah. the way the world is. Like yeah. you know, most people, they can't taste the difference between, you know, like something that's like a $5 chocolate bar and a $2 chocolate bar. You know, they yeah. appreciate the brand. They appreciate the story. Yes. You know, yes. they want something that they're told is healthier for them, but they're not going to yes. be as discerning as, no. as my community was. So I think that was a huge yeah. lesson for me is there a way for you? It doesn't mean you have to, you know, hire some expensive research firm. It just means like, try to find a situation where it's not just your friends and family. I think yeah. that was something that was really big. And then the other thing is, not to be afraid to think really big. And I think that when I was first fundraising, you know, like now that I know much more about it, I really kind of was just so in shock that people would even want to give me any money that I didn't really think about the long term, like if I was to raise many, many rounds, like what would this look like? And I think that just not being afraid to set yourself up for a big vision. I think that that's only rewarded, in my opinion. And I think that being able to embrace that and set yourself up in the beginning for that is also important.
Yes. Well, I'm just thinking of that. A lot of the things that we see with brands when they're struggling, particularly on the innovation side and talking to the point that you're saying is oftentimes, when you're looking at that immediate, those people that are around you that are giving you feedback, you need a little bit of that just simply because you need a little bit of ego stroke. You need some love because this is a personal thing that you're working on.
Yeah.
But you do need to get input from people who don't care who you are and who don't censor themselves because that's where your real market opportunity is.
Yeah.
And, so good on you for moving in that direction. Sounds like you did that pretty quick, or was there a little bit of time before you got that insight?
I think that it was whispering all the time, mm-hmm. but I think what's hard is like, I didn't do that like, what would be the cross section? I think, and this is also just me knowing, not understanding the food and beverage yep. world more, yep. where yep. now I know that there's a big difference between a grocery product and a farmer's market product. Yeah. Right. Yes. And so I was getting in my mind, like all of this, like, you know, unbiased data going to craft fairs and farmer's mm-hmm. markets or people mm-hmm. who are really looking for that kind of product yep. that I had, and that's really different than something that's going to sit on a grocery shelf. Yeah. So I think like literally yeah. like someone was saying, like, you know, they might tell you to, they might shoo you away, but like go outside of Whole Foods and like, yeah. just like survey their customers yes. and ask yes. them if they want to try this and if they'd buy it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that just to be bold that way would have been helpful earlier. And mm-hmm. I think that the real aha moment came when we started to get into grocery stores and that the managers would tell me that it sold well. And I was like, it doesn't sell well. It sells really, really, really slow. But they were yeah. saying this for this category, for a yeah. cooking product, you know, yeah. Americans just don't cook that much. I had no right. idea. And so if Americans aren't cooking that much, you just do the math and it's not going to be very easy to sell enough to make a living. And right. so, and I remember we got into Sam's Club. Sam's oh Club gave us this like huge purchase order. It was more than the whole lifetime revenue of the company. Oh my and goodness. They put in a clause there that if it didn't sell, I'd have to buy it back from them.
Oh, that's brutal.
And yeah. I just remember thinking to myself, because I remember my sister at the time was like, well, maybe you should just do it. Just do it. And I was like, I don't believe it's going to sell. And I was like, I have the wrong product and I have to start over.
Yeah.
And just to have that realization and to be able to admit it was really hard.
Good. So, like that's good self-reflection and listening. I also not a big fan of buybacks for younger brands.
In general, either. I would never agree to that.
Yeah.
Ever. But I think it was the fact that I was like, I know that this product,
yeah.
that I know that the chance of this not selling, just realizing that was yeah. actually really the issue with the business. Of course, I was going to say no to that, those kinds of terms for food. I mean, yeah. that puts an entrepreneur in such a bad position.
Yes.
But it was the fact that I didn't believe it was going to sell. Like, I would probably take that deal. I wouldn't, but if like my business hinged upon it, like I would bet on this coffee for sure, you know?
Yeah. Well, so what's been your proudest moment to date with Copper Cow Coffee?
What's been my proudest moment to date? That's a really good question. You know, recently we instated paying full healthcare for all of our employees.
Aww.
And I remember when I was first able to afford any healthcare a couple years ago, and just being like, you know, because it feels so terrible to be offering people's jobs and just being like, there's no healthcare. You're my first employee, and it's just this, you know, minimum wage job. And then being able to say, like, okay, we have enough employees where I can offer healthcare benefits that are at the minimum that I could possibly afford.
Yeah.
And to have the company and partners in place where we believe that this is something that's important for the team, I think that was just a really great moment of it symbolizes like that it's a real company. It symbolizes that we're investing in people. Yes. It symbolizes that you know, we're not afraid to say that your health is like one of the most important things at this company. So I think that's something that it's funny. It really has been like a really big, proud moment for me.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, I love hearing that. And I love that this is not the right fit for everybody, but I love that it's not, I don't know, financial or distribution or something like that, because this is all about people and community. That's awesome.
Yeah, because when you raise money, obviously there's relief in there mm-hmm. there is pride, but mm-hmm. it's also like that money is by no means an accomplishment. It's just an opportunity to go do things, you know. And each time I get into a retailer, it's just an opportunity to you know, get to like serve customers, everything.
Yes.
I still feel like we're at the point where most things are just an opportunity. Even when you make a purchase, it's just an opportunity for us to convince you it's an amazing product that you'll buy again. You know, I think that we're still in such a, I think that the brand is just getting started, and being able to have the right people is the only way we're going to get there, you know?
Oh my goodness. That's awesome. Well, now looking forward, what's the future look like for you and even Copper Cow Coffee? What's the next couple of years look like? Or what do you hope to take over the world? What's
always in the back of my mind, taking over the world, obviously. But on the road to that, over the next couple of years, I think that there's two things that I'm really excited about. One is, it's been really amazing in the pandemic that people are so open to subscription, that's become something that people have much more dependable consumption habits, especially at home, and that this has become such a wonderful way for us to be able to serve and honor our customer, to give them better pricing and better products, and being able to invest in that experience to be able to like own the whole coffee moment, I think is something that's been really, really exciting. So investing in that strategy, I think, is probably the front of mind about how to create this wonderful like thing that you get to look forward to every day at home. And then on the other end of that, I think we're really excited that I know that the pour over is just the first expression of Vietnamese coffee that we're bringing to market. And I really can't wait to make it even more accessible, you know, and I think that we've got some innovation in the pipeline, that we're going to be launching new products next year. And I think that's something that I'm very, very excited for.
Ooh, I'll be keeping my eye on that. So Debbie, our time is almost up, but I have a few questions that I ask every single guest, and I'd love to go ahead and, I'm just going to go ahead and ask them. The first one, I think you've already provided in some way, shape or form, but I'm going to ask it a different way. And that is, I love it when a guest provides some sort of interesting fact. I call it my happy hour fact, the did you know water cooler fact, about their industry or the category that they're in. Do you have some sort of like sound bite about Vietnamese coffee or anything else that our listeners could take away with them today? Might be tricky because you gave some good ones earlier already. So maybe we could tuck that one away if you don't have one that pops up right away.
I don't have one that pops up right away. Or actually I have one that I think is interesting.
Okay.
That I've learned about coffee behavior in the US. Okay. Because a lot of times, you know, we're one of the few coffee companies that sell coffee with cream and sugar.
Okay.
That you can add to it, of course, but that's about 70% of our customers buy it with the creamer.
Oh.
And I thought that seemed high. And then I found out that 70% of Americans drink their coffee with milk and sugar every day.
Well,
and I think that being a coastal resident, being an LA resident, you know, I think of people drinking black coffee. I drink my coffee black most days. And then the sweetened condensed milk is more of like an afternoon treat. And so I think that's been really interesting to learn learn a lot more about how the US as a whole is drinking mm-hmm. coffee.
Well, I bet if we took a look at Frappuccino sales, we could probably do some quick math, and that might mic out for us. Hey,
exactly.
That's so funny. Okay. Are there any other women leaders or rising stars in our industry or not that you would like to elevate or just simply admire for the work that they're doing right now and why?
Are you still there? I think it might have just... Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Let me ask that question again,
sure.
Okay, just in case.
Yeah.
Are there any other women leaders or rising stars out there in our industry or not that you would like to elevate or simply admire for the work that they're doing right now, and then why?
Great question. I have two people.
Okay.
That I've really had a lot of great mentorship over the past several years that I've mm-hmm. been doing this. One would be Natasha from Cool House Ice Cream.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the first people I met who, you know, really, really, and this is back when I still had just the oil and vinegar product, because she's a hardcore foodie, and she was just really blown away by it and really has been so supportive every step of the way. And so mm-hmm. I think that's somebody who I can't believe, like, I think something that's so surprising after having really felt like it was hard to find mentors in my last career, how generous and available female entrepreneurs are.
Yes.
You know, and I think that another person that is always a phone call away, is Reshma, the founder of Somersault, who started off in bathing suits, and now they are taking over the world in terms of all apparel. And you know, she's always available, whether it's something that I'm trying to figure out how to create great culture, how to find investors. You know, she's always available for a half hour call, even though I met her back when she was, you know, just starting out, and she always makes herself available to me, even though we've never met in person. But mm-hmm. you know, she and which is normal now in the pandemic, but she's just somebody who's so generous, and I can't say enough great things about her as an inspiring mentor.
Well, that's awesome. Well, shout out to them. We'll make sure they get some extra love today.
Yeah.
All right. And then my last question is, what brands or trends do you have your eye on right now, and why?
Well, a friend of mine started this company, Function of Beauty, that I think is just so exciting. And that's customized hair care. Now they've gone into some other beauty products. But I think the idea of people wanting something that's customized to their behaviors and having that come to them where there's a small element of surprise and delight, mm-hmm. but that they get to say exactly what they want and mm-hmm. exactly for their needs, is something that's very inspiring to me, that I think there's going to be more of in terms of the world of CPG automation.
Oh, that's awesome. That sounds great. I'm going to have to look them up.
Yeah.
What's the name again?
Oh, Function of Beauty.
Function of Beauty. Okay. I'll have to take that. Well, we have been talking with Debbie Way Mullen. I got that right, didn't I?
Yes.
Woohoo. The CEO and founder of Coffer Cow Coffee. I have to record that all over again. I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on.
Go for it.
Okay. We've been talking with Debbie Way Mullen, co-founder. I'm going to do this one more time. It's clearly
take your time. I know. It's one of those days.
All right. We've been talking with Debbie Way Mullen, founder and CEO of Coffer Cow Coffee. Debbie, where can people learn more about you?
Definitely on our website at coppercowcoffee.com. But starting in October, you'll be able to find us in every Whole Foods in the country, which will be very exciting.
Oh my goodness.
And then every Sprouts. And then we're also in a bunch of other retail grocery stores, but those are the two that we'll be in. You can find us anywhere in the country.
Oh my gosh. I love it. Debbie, thank you so much for your time today and for all that you're doing for CPG and for other women entrepreneurs. Really enjoyed our time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Talk to you all soon.
Enjoyed this episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to click subscribe and share with your network. Until next time, be well and do gooder.